think we're okay now, Mr. Gerdt. Please proceed.
Just a couple of follow-up questions in view of the objection.
No, I haven't. I'm letting him respond to staff.
Just a couple of follow-up questions in regard to staff's objection. Would you look at page 12 of Warren Fisher's testimony, please?
Yes.
Line 211.
Give me a second.
Would you read that sentence that starts the factors that result?
The factors that result from this process represent reasonable estimates of how Mid-Continent would, were an ILAC, likewise allocate costs consistent with the FCC's methodology.
And what does that mean to you in terms of the accuracy of the cost study?
I believe that the claim that this has never been done has no bearing on the validity. Obviously, Mid-Continent has never had to perform a study like this or any other cost study for regulatory purposes. Therefore, the claim that it has never been done before can be levied against any Mid-Continent study. And therefore, what staff is in effect saying is that Mid-Continent should never present any cost study. And that would leave the Commission deprived of knowing what Mid-Continent's cost is. And I believe that what we have done in this study is to do exactly what other ILACs do. So we were treating Mid-Continent, who is a CLAC, as an ILAC, and saying, if you had done this, how would you do it? And this is how you do it.
And I'm not sure where we would be in this objection process, but I don't believe he was responsive to the question in front of him, and so asked that his answer be stricken. I'm not sure what he was addressing, but it certainly wasn't anything I objected to, nor did it appear to be Mr. Gerdes's question, but...
It's noted. I'm going to overrule it, and we'll just move on here, Mr. Gerdes. Do you have any further questions Foundation?
And then also, as to the question that was asked about paragraph 1-3, and this is a confidential response from from Mid-Continent. And then that response, however, also refers to request for information 1-2, which is non-confidential. And I would ask that terms that are set forth in 1-2 be also considered in determining the relevance of the objection, because it basically goes on and discusses the entire cost study process. And for those reasons, we would ask that the exhibit be admitted into evidence.
Okay, you're aware that we don't have those data, so we don't have a clue as to what that says. But
I can give you my copy if you think you need it. I mean,
or if you feel you want it for purposes of appeal, I would suggest maybe you ought to mark it and offer the response as an exhibit.
Okay. Can I mark it later? I can make it available to you now to look at.
I don't want to look at it. Maybe the commissioners do, though. And because of this issue is obviously pivotal here, I'm going to see if the commissioners have any questions relative to the admissibility of this document, because ultimately they're going to have to make that ruling.
Mr. Smith, it's not that I don't want to see it. It's just I don't know what I'd do with it right now. I mean, I'm taking an hour-long recess for me to review and parse it. I'm not sure it's of much benefit. It's just pop in front of me.
Exactly. I mean, he described what it was, and it looks like a multiple-page document, and we'll be at it for a while if we're going to read the whole thing. So I take you at face value that it's a description of the process he went through in completing the study. And will you will admit that data response?
Yes, I will. I will put the response into the record at the next break.
Okay. Commissioners, do you have any questions relative to this document, relative to its admissibility or non-admissibility?
May I ask a question, Ms. Kramer? I'm going to be foundation questions for the witness.
Please, yes.
Ms. Kramer, help me understand, keep in mind I'm a non-attorney, but is there harm in the commission accepting the cost study as the, you know, and giving it the weight it deserves, understanding that it's an imperfect and it's an estimate, and that even those that prepared it have indicated it has some limitations?
The harm would be, from staff's point of view, is if it were used as a basis for determining their switched access rate, because it is an unreviewed cost study. And in other cost studies, do not begin with gap accounting and do magic to make them fit with uniform system of accounts. And I don't believe that's a proven method. I'm not sure it has been shown to be accurate in any manner. And so I object as it being used as a basis for determining their switched access rate at this point. It's possible that the commission could accept the cost study and have it reviewed by someone else. Now, I'll tell you right now, as you know, we don't have anyone on staff who's capable of reviewing a cost study, which means we would have to hire, you would have to hire a consultant to review that cost study. That will be expensive, obviously. I believe at that point, this docket would need to be turned into a cost study docket, which we then assess filing fees for, which then Mid-Continent has to pay for that consultant to review a cost study if you ultimately determine you want to use this cost study. And that's the basis for my objection.
If I may be heard, it would seem to me, Your Honors, that we've been talking about this cost study with staff for over a year. April 2007, I think, is when we started. And they had ample time to do all the discovery they wanted. And right now we're here at a hearing, it's time, we believe, to go forward. And for that reason, we would urge the commission to admit the cost study into evidence give it the weight that they believe it deserves.
In response to that, they just amended their petition to include this cost study. Up to that, they were not asking for this cost study rate. And so we have not had adequate time to review this. We never thought it would be in front of this commission.
I agree that the amendment was late, but I disagree with the characterization that the cost study was never going to be used. I mean, it's been on the front of conversations, multiple conversations with staff. At this late date, I mean, if staff wanted the more time, why don't they make a motion to postpone the hearing then or something else? But to just say we shouldn't consider it, why are we here? It should be considered.
Are there any other commissioner questions or observations?
And just as a final, to make sure the record's accurate here, we had to ask them for the cost study. It was not provided to us.
Mr. Smith, another question, if I might.
Please, Commissioner Johnson.
Ms. Kramer, you talked about a conversion or, you know, into a cost study docket. I mean, I know this started as a petition for, you know, waiver. Given their amended petition, I mean, is it your opinion that we're not in a cost study proceeding right now? I mean, does the commission not have the authority to provide them relief under paragraph 6 of the amended petition?
When we started this, it was a waiver, and that's how it's titled. And then I understand captions have no legal relevance, but there was no filing fee assessed. We didn't take the normal steps of a cost study docket that staff normally would. And now that it has spun into this, as I thought about it the other day, trying to figure out, should I be booking my time on this because of, you know, what I'm doing with cost studies, I realize that you know, we looked at it as one thing when it was filed. It has now seemed to have taken on a different life. So as to your question, can you provide the relief? What was it in?
Under paragraph 6 of their amended petition, I mean, they asked for the commission to permit the file of its cost study and establish company-specific cost to determine switched access rates.
And when I read that, that's when I started thinking about all this, and that's what I thought. If you're going to do that, I think then it has to turn into something else here. You know, obviously the commission can do whatever they want and can accept the cost study at its face value. Staff's recommendation would be if you do accept the cost study and use that as a basis for determining their switched access rate, that much more would need to be done with the cost study.
Anything further?
May I ask you? I would submit that it's a little late to bring that up at this time. I mean, Ms. Kramer was talking about the other day. Why wasn't this objection made months ago? Or let's just say when the amendment was proposed. There was a commission meeting, and the commission, without objection from staff, approved the amendment to the petition. We now have the petition in front of us. We have a hearing that's been noticed. I mean, I think it's patently unfair for staff to now take the position that we can't go forward with this this proof when everybody is here, when due process was served, when everybody was at the commission meeting, when the amended petition was approved. We're here to prove our case. And I would submit that at this late date, the characterization of this objection is out of order.
And I would just remind Mr. Gerdes that when you and I and Mr. Smith met, I told you at that time that I would be objecting to the cost study. When we met one Friday a few weeks ago, and you knew there was discussion about should you do an amended petition, and I told you at that point we would be objecting to the cost study.
I don't recall that, but I'll take your word for it. If that's what you said, you said it. But nonetheless, we have an amended petition here, and there was no objection to the amended petition, and it was approved by the commission. So you're entitled to do your objection, but I don't mean to address counsel. I should be addressing the commission. But at this point, if that was the case, we should have known before we got everybody here and got this thing underway. We're going to try and convert this to something that's not. And so I would submit that the cost study should either be admitted into evidence or not, up or down, and we proceed.
My ruling, of course, subject to the commission's right to overrule me, is to admit it. And again, by that, I do not in any way intend to sanction it as a cost study conforming to the commission's procedures, rules, etc., set forth in chapters 27 through 29. The context within which this has been submitted to us and within which I'm admitting it for purposes of the hearing today was in conjunction, in fact, with a request for waiver from the commission's rules by Mid-Continent, by the petitioner. And again, I'm admitting it for what it is. And the way I read the testimony of Mr. Fisher, at least, his pre-filed testimony, is, in my view, he's quite forthright in that testimony about laying out the differences between this and cost studies that might have been submitted in previous cases by ILEX that use the USOA routinely. He has clearly set forth in there that these were translations that were done. And again, with all of those obvious differences, for purposes of this hearing, which again is a request for a waiver, and the use of this as a proxy, I guess we would call it, I'm going to admit it, and staff is perfectly willing to point out its weaknesses, as it has in argument, and through its testimony today, and to convince the commission that they ought not rely on it for purposes of setting a rate. And with that, I'm going to admit it, subject to the commission's right to overrule me. Hearing nothing, Midco Exhibit 3 is admitted.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Now I'd like to go to Exhibit 7.
Could you identify for me which exhibit I'm looking for?
Yes. Exhibit 7 would be the dissent of Commissioner Harold Footgott-Raw.
Yes.
That also was objected to by staff, and so I'd like to lay some foundation for that exhibit, if I may, Mr. Smith.
Please proceed. I don't think you need to lay a whole lot. It's, again, it's an official government document that was part of the decisional documents in the same case, so I wouldn't waste a whole lot of time.
Where did you obtain this dissent of the commissioner that's before you as Exhibit 7? Where did it come from?
It's attached to the FCC CLAC Excess Reform Order, which is the seventh report and order that was submitted into evidence this morning. Since I'm not a lawyer, I don't know if it is, strictly speaking, part of that order, but when you download the order, this comes with it, and it offers a vigorous dissent 8 years ago of the policy, and I thought it would be informative for the commission. Rather than the commission having to look it up themselves, I decided to make it readily available to them.
Offer Exhibit 7.
Staff.
Thank you. Staff would object on terms of relevancy. It is a dissent. It is has to do with interstate, and I have no opportunity to cross-examine the witness.
The objection is overruled. I'm going to admit the statement of Commissioner, and I'm going to forget the first half his name, Roth. I don't have a clue as to how to pronounce that. It's admitted. To me, it's part of the overall expression of policy that went into that of the FCC. I don't think the FCC's decision is binding on us either. Those documents are precedent and guidance for the commission, and I'm going to admit it on that basis.
Mr. Smith, a question about your decision, if I might.
By all means.
Given that we didn't admit the FCC order as evidence, why would we admit the dissent? I mean, we took judicial notice of the order, and if this is attached to it, isn't this already been noted by the commission?
It probably has been, and it's probably already admitted by judicial notice as part of the order. It's one of the parts of the order. That's correct.
If I may, but it's also part of and referred to in Dr. Ankum's testimony, and so it's an exhibit as to the testimony would be relevant to reading and understanding his testimony.
Well, maybe if we do that, why don't we make it consistent and mark another exhibit and introduce the order itself as well, and we'll do that. How does that, is that acceptable?
Well, I don't know what's right. Certainly want to provide you deference. I just wanted to make sure I understood what we were doing.
I don't know that it really, it's both of those elements, like with any Supreme Court decision, it's all part of the overall order in my view. It's not, it's an official document in the United States government. To me, it is clearly relevant on this subject. One way or another, I don't care how you want to do it, Mr. Gertis, let's do it consistently. Either admit, we'll either have them both in as exhibits, or we'll just take judicial notice of the whole order, including dissents and appendices.
That's fine. I have no objection to that.
Okay, we'll just do that then. We'll take judicial notice of the whole order, including any dissenting or any other opinion views that are appended to the order. Yours wasn't in there. Are we okay with that?
Sure, that's fine. We'll tender Dr. Ancombe for cross-examination.
Thank you. Staff has no questions.
Commissioners, do you have questions, Dr. Ancombe?
I do. Thanks. Dr. Ancombe, I have reason to believe through your testimony that you followed the FCC at least on some level for a number of years. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you find that their transitional solutions often stay in place much longer than anticipated?
They sometimes do. They sometimes don't. Some of them linger and others don't. As to this particular one, I think the reason it has lingered so long is because the question of intercarrier compensation, which is compensation between carriers at the wholesale level, of which switch access is an integral component, is particularly intractable. It's a difficult issue to come to terms with. And that paired with the resource constraints of the FCC, as I discussed in my summary, the FCC was threatened to be overwhelmed through that complaint process. I think that explains why the FCC hasn't come to terms with the larger issue. And, of course, now it is going to have to, in part, under, I believe, a court order.
As a professional who follows the FCC, do you believe that comprehensive ICC reform is forthcoming on the federal level?
I don't have a crystal ball in that regard. And, to be honest, I'm not really sure which direction the FCC is going to go with this. And again, when I said the problem is particularly intractable, I think it truly is. There's so many places of which carriers interconnect with each other, and all the tricky questions of public utility regulation come into play about which company has the market power, which company has whom over a barrel. And I think the FCC, because of that, hasn't been able to make much headway. So I think that's my reading of the situation. And now they're ordered to come to terms with it, and they have made announcements that they will, but I'm not holding my breath.
On page 19 of your pre-file testimony, you note, and I'm looking on line 6 and 7, that Quest, as other large ILECs, received all sorts of consideration in return for exchange access reductions which do not benefit CLECs. And I believe this is given in context about the difficulty of lifting out of context one settled rate and applying it to another carrier. Do you know what concessions Quest made as part of that proceeding?
No. And I think that's part of the point that I'm making. I've partaken in proceedings like that. I worked for the Texas Commission for 7 years, and Southwestern Bell went through some proceedings. And what often happens, and I've seen the same process take place at the FCC and other commissions, is that the interested parties sit down in a back room, so to speak, and there are oftentimes different interest groups that are gathered there with different objectives. Typically, staffs, of course, have the concern about the affordability of rates. The company will have concern about recovering its cost, and oftentimes the other investment projects involved, issues of price cap regulation. And what happens is that parties work out a stipulation that involve many different considerations. Then what sees the light of day oftentimes is a commission order, which is some distillation of that,
but all the deliberations that led to the stipulation oftentimes are verbal and therefore not really translated into a commission order. So I do not know, if you ask me, do I know specifically what happened in South Dakota with Quest? My answer is I do not know exactly all the considerations that were taken into account when Quest settled on the rates that it did.
Do you have factual knowledge of any concession that Quest might have made as a part of that proceeding?
I believe there were considerations about rate shock. Quest also is a recipient of universal service subsidies, and because of those subsidies, Quest is able to do an analysis that Mid-Continent is not able to do. Quest can sit back and say, which are all of my revenue streams? I have my wholesale revenues coming from switched access, then I have my local service rates, which give me money, and then I have subsidies from the Universal Service Fund. If all of those together keep me whole, then I as a company can continue to operate viably. Mid-Continent is in a different situation. Mid-Continent is being squeezed between the retail rates it can charge in competition with Quest, then it has its wholesale side of the business, which are the switched access rates, but it doesn't have those subsidy flows coming from universal service. So it sits in a different situation. And so I suppose the gist of my testimony is you can't just pluck for a number of reasons. Part of it is this deal-making, but I've cited other reasons, namely that Quest, of course, is a huge company and Mid-Continent is far smaller. So obviously Quest is going to have a very, very different cost structure than Mid-Continent, but that's not what you're asking me about.
On page 13 of your pre-file direct, you note that, and I'm looking on lines 3 and 4, that competition in retail markets disciplines market behavior in upstream wholesale markets for exchange access markets as well.
Yes.
If the market for switched access is sufficiently disciplined, then why are cost studies necessary at all?
I think you put your finger on exactly the critical issue and the overarching, like the 10,000 point view of what's going on. When CLEX were created, so to speak, with the Telecom Act, they were presumptively competitive, and regulators have held back from regulating any of their rates. I believe why we have offered a cost study here is because when Mid-Continent came to the Commission with a request to tariff certain rates, as a presumptively competitive carrier, staff gave pushback. Now, what my argument is that regulators, with the passage of the Telecom Act of 96, the notion was to infuse into the telecom industry, which traditionally was characterized by monopoly companies, to infuse into that a competitive element. And the notion was not that regulators would start regulating those smaller companies that compete with the incumbents. That is, however, what we're slowly seeing transforming here. So staff is giving pushback and is not willing to let Mid-Continent tariff its switched access rates. So Mid-Continent thinks the market disciplines it. Staff thinks that there is market imperfection. Mr. Sanger is talking about monopoly power that CLEC, like Mid-Continent, have in his testimony, and I address that. I think then, to sum it up, because I see you have a next question, it's a two-step process. I would say, first, as a regulator, you want to rely on competition because competition generally does a better job than that we as regulators and participants can do. But once you say, no, I don't trust markets, then you default to a standard paradigm, and the standard paradigm is that wholesale rates are set at levels that allow a company to recoup its cost. That's where the cost study comes in.
So do you believe in the switched access arena that we're talking about, the markets do provide enough discipline?
Yes. Now, that's a complex story, and my yes doesn't really do justice to the explanation. If you want me to explain? This is the notion. Mid-Continent is a small player in a large industry. In that large industry, it has to hold its own. Now, it has attracted customers at the retail level. There is competition at the retail level. When different carriers look at Mid-Continent, they see that Mid-Continent has certain customers. These customers are associated with revenue streams and profits. Now, the revenues and profits associated with the retail customer include, in part, the rates that the retail customer pays to Mid-Continent, but there's also a derived demand for switched access, for the inter-carrier traffic and compensation. Those dollars, too, translate into profits. So when the retail competition is taking place, carriers look at the various end users and say, ah, there's Mid-Continent. Now, if Mid-Continent has exorbitant Swiss access rates, then Mid-Continent may perhaps set a low retail rate, but everybody in the industry knows that the high profits on the access side. That makes that customer a highly desirable customer and therefore will be a target for competition. So what you have is that competition at the retail level disciplines markets at the wholesale level. That's how the process works.
If that market is sufficiently well-disciplined and competitive, then why do we see such differences in the rates that Quest and the CLEX are charging? Is my presumption that a competitive market would normally drive the prices for products toward a competitor's prices? Is that flawed?
No. At the retail level, that is true. Markets will generate prices that are somewhat uniform, but not at the wholesale level. At the wholesale level, a carrier doesn't have an interest in, or let me put it differently, will try to set its consistent with, and again, with the standing paradigm, regulatory paradigm. Wholesale rates are set at cost, whether it's switch access, whether it's unbundled network elements that the ILECs have to make available under Section 251 of the Act. You're familiar with that. You always have these proceedings in which you say, what are the costs and how shall we set rates? Well, you set rates based on cost. Now, secondly, if you have a commodity, prices gravitate to a uniform level. Switched access is not a commodity. It is provided by a specific company with a specific cost structure to other companies. And once you move away from the commodity product, which it is at a retail level to some extent, and you move to the wholesale level, then you will start to see variations in cost, as you see in other industries. Companies have different cost structures. Mid-Continent is much smaller, doesn't enjoy the economies of scale of Quest. That's one explanation. The other explanation is that staff has been interventionist in the wholesale markets. Quest rates are regulated, and so the regulatory influences on Quest rates, it doesn't necessarily reflect exactly where Quest costs are. So there is I want to use the word contrivance, not in a pejorative term, but again, because it's part of an overall deal-making process, what you see is Quest rates. Well, there shouldn't be any presumption that Quest rates somehow would represent a competitive market rate, because it's not. Then you have, for example, Sancom, which is another company that staff has hauled out to Mid-Continent to mirror the rates off. And again, that is a rate that hasn't been determined by a free market. That's a rate, again, that is established by staff and under the threat, I believe, of intervention of AT&T at a minimum. And that distorts what Sancom, as a relatively small company, can charge. It is making concessions. Now, Mid-Continent was not part of that deal, but there's absolutely no reason to assume that somehow Sancom's rates have any merit outside of the deal that Sancom has decided that it can live with.
You raise in your pre-filed direct concerns about cross-subsidization if an access rate is below the cost recovery rate. Do you have any concerns about cross-subsidization that would occur if the switched access rate is higher than a cost-based rate plus a rate of return?
Again, there's a two-step process. First, I would advocate that for CLEX, that the retail markets discipline the wholesale markets, and CLEX are presumptively competitive, and I don't believe that regulators need to have concerns about where these rates are. If Mid-Continent were to set its rate exorbitantly high, other carriers would spot that, and there would be fierce competition for Mid-Continent's end users, and there would be attrition of its customer base, and Mid-Continent would be hurt, and as such would be disciplined. However, if you are going to be interfering in the market and going to be setting rates, then I believe you should indeed set the rates based on cost and not above cost. For the reason I believe that you're contemplating that, if you set the rates artificially above cost, then the general dictum in economic theory holds that rates that are above cost are not in the general public interest. It's detrimental to general welfare. So I think as an economist, I like to see rates commensurate with cost, either through the competitive process or through the regulatory process.
Have you done any analysis on what, if Mid-Continent was allowed to charge its own switched access rate, what rate it would have to charge to incent additional competition in the Huawei market?
No, if not.
I think just one or two more, perhaps, Mr. Smith. Thanks for your patience. In those instances, Dr. Ankum, when you've been retained by a public utilities commission to review a cost study, how long have you normally had to review that cost study?
Oh, it actually varies greatly. It also depends on how many cost studies are at play. For example,
Let me simplify it a little bit. If the commission had retained QSI to review a cost study like the one that has been admitted into evidence for Mid-Continent, how long would you estimate it would take for you to conduct a review of that?
I think 3 months would allow a knowledgeable person to do a thorough review of this cost study, particularly given that one would be dealing with a company that is very cooperative, i.e. you can call in the company and sit down with Mid-Continent and just walk through the study, ask all the questions that you want to answer, that you want answered. And again, to explain a little bit why that's so important, we have been in many proceedings where we're dealing with uncooperative companies. When QSI is reviewing the cost studies of Quest or Verizon or AT&T, oftentimes it's a slugfest where we're asking for information and we can't get it, and we need commission orders to get the information that we're looking for, and I don't think that would ever be the case here. So I think 3 months would be a reasonable time.
And my final question, on page 41 of your pre-filed direct, you, and I'm looking on lines 15, 16, 17, you note in the SANCOM proceeding that Quest's and AT&T's interventions and the settlement indicate that there must have been some degree of deal-making going on.
Yes.
Do you have any factual knowledge of any concessions that may have been made by SANCOM or any other carrier that was a party to that proceeding?
Well, I believe that SANCOM's willingness to the factual evidence is the fact that SANCOM came down from its initial request and then has a rate that is ratcheting down to Quest rate, which obviously wasn't SANCOM's initial proposal, and it's not obvious why SANCOM would do that without the arm twisting of the larger carriers. And to put it a bit in perspective, AT&T, and Verizon, which wasn't in this case here, but apparently, are the largest purchasers of switch access services from CLEX. And across the country, we have seen AT&T engaging in big-time self-help where it's just refusing to pay the money it owes to CLEX. And I do not know this for a fact, but I'm almost certain that AT&T is probably dealing with SANCOM along those same lines, where it would not be paying SANCOM the rates that SAMCOM is looking for and saying, I will only pay you if you bring your rates down. And that is the kind of deal-making I'm talking about. It's heavy-handed, and it's not representative of anything.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Schneider.
Other commissioner questions? Does the petitioner have any questions responsive to the commissioner's questions?
I do, if I may. Commissioner Johnson asked you about the timing of the FCC decisions. Should this commission defer to the FCC on intra-state access charges?
No.
And it may be obvious, but why?
Okay. The FCC and the states are always doing this complicated dance about who is picking up the cost for what part of the network. That's what the entirety of the jurisdictional separation process is about, pushing costs back and forth. There's a joint board process involved where the states and the FCC meet and work out certain details, but ultimately, of course, it's the FCC's prerogative to set the rates and the processes to which these rates are established for the interstate jurisdiction. But again, the FCC, as it is setting the rates and therefore the recovery mechanism for switched access services, it knows very well that it's pushing other costs into the state jurisdictions. It's like yin and yang. They're connected. That also means, of course, that if the FCC disallows recovery of certain costs, those costs don't go away. The companies still need to recoup those costs. It would be the worst public policy if states just blindly follow the FCC and set rates according to an FCC policy, which again the FCC never really claimed was a sound policy. It was just a convenient, expedient policy. It would be terrible if the states blindly follow that, because it puts companies in a position where they can't recover the cost, and if they can't recover the cost, you place the entire competitive process in jeopardy. Consumers are best served, I believe, not by a short-term solution of setting rates low. Consumers are, I think, and ratepayers are best served when the commission creates a structure in which local competition can flourish, and that's in the long-term interest of ratepayers.
Would you recommend that this commission defer its decision in this matter until after the FCC issues a decision on intercarrier compensation?
No, I would not. I would not want to have this commission predicate its decision again on an FCC policy. I believe that the commission has its own rules. I think those rules are sound. They speak to how switched access charges should be recovered. They should be the cost of switched access services should be recovered based on cost. That is all over your rules. I don't see why it would be any different for CLEX. I believe the commission has ample information before it to make its decisions about what is reasonable, and I believe that the commission, with the information it has available, the policy analysis that I have provided, I think that the commission is in a position to make a reasonable decision on it. I don't think, given that the FCC is about to overhaul its own policies, that the commission should mirror a outdated FCC policy. That it should not do.
Well, I guess a follow-up question to that is, given the FCC's track record so far in this area, is there any chance that the FCC will figure out some way to punt the ball yet again?
It can do that. That's, as I said earlier, I wouldn't hold my breath. And secondly, again, what the FCC will be laying out is a policy for interstate switch access. I don't think that the FCC is going to be reaching into the state authority and deal with what falls under your purview. So even if the FCC does resolve the issues, it's going to be interesting to see how it will do that. It doesn't necessarily, again, dictate to a state commission how it should be dealing with its own carriers for its own intrastate services. I think you have your own responsibilities there.
You were asked some questions about market dynamics. How would Mid-Continent be impacted if, as an example, NVC were allowed to charge access rates that were twice as high as the rates MNCO charges?
I think that's where the parity issue comes in. The parity doesn't necessarily go to just the rate levels. The parity goes, in large part, to the ability to recover your cost. If Mid-Continent has to compete with a carrier that is able to recover its cost, and Mid-Continent is not, then Mid-Continent would be competing with one hand tied to its back. And so in that sense, I believe that the parity principle would be violated.
You were asked about cross-subsidization. What is a confiscatory rate?
And of course I'm not a lawyer, there's a legal aspect to confiscation that I've tried to figure out as non-lawyer by reading Supreme Court.
I'm going to object, as he has now stated a couple of times, he really can't answer this question because he's not a lawyer and it apparently it calls for a legal conclusion, so I would object.
Overruled, you can go ahead and answer.
Yeah. As an economist, however, I would say that confiscatory would be rates that are explicitly set below a company's cost. And I cite in my testimony the Coles order, C-A-L-L-S, and another FCC order where it is discussing price cap regulation and it's laying out a new framework for access charges. And in paragraph 17 of the Coles order, the FCC itself is using the phrase confiscatory, and it's talking about how even under price caps, the relationship between rates and cost has not been severed. And I'll read to you here a quote that I happen to have. It makes an allowance for an ILEC to come in and adjust the rates under the price caps. It says, moreover, a price cap LEC may petition the Commission to set its rates above the levels permitted by the price cap indices based on a showing that the authorized rate levels will produce earnings that are so low as to be confiscatory. And I think there, that goes to the heart of the matter. When a regulatory agency knows for fact that rates are below the cost of a company, then those rates are confiscatory, and I think the regulatory agency has an obligation to raise those rates to a level that are compensatory.
What is a compensatory rate?
Compensatory rate is a rate where a company is allowed to, well, the opportunity to recover its legitimately incurred cost.
And what is MNCO asking here for here, a compensatory rate or a confiscatory rate?
I believe that Mid-Continent is fairly asking for a rate that is compensatory, that is not a rate above cost, as Mr. Sanger claims in his testimony, and I might add, without any foundation grounded in a cost study, but just a claim that Mid-Continent's requested rate is above cost. Nor are we asking for a rate that is below our cost or Mid-Continent's cost. I think Mid-Continent is simply asking the Commission to set the rates based on a reasonable estimate of their costs.
You were asked about the appropriate time to review cost studies. Given the fact that QSI and Mid-Continent presented a cost study methodology to staff in April of last year, do you believe that and has been in communication with staff periodically since then, do you believe that staff has had an opportunity to review what has been termed the LECA cost study before this hearing?
I'm going to object as a speculative and a misstatement of the facts.
I guess maybe we don't know what the facts are, so do you want to elucidate a bit?
The cost study, did you say April of what?
2007.
Okay, that would have been the TELREC.
Well,
the first
the first
cost
one.
Study that's been referenced.
And the second one, don't flash it to me across. I can't see that far. And the second one was put in the file on July 15th of 08.
Yeah. I believe our evidence shows that the second one was presented in April of 08.
And as I had stated earlier in my earlier objection to the cost study, staff was reviewing this as a waiver docket, not a cost study docket, and it was not reviewed, and I believe everybody understood that it was not being reviewed by commission staff.
Does staff now acknowledge that it did? We don't know. Did staff receive a copy of the revised cost study at some point prior to July 15th? I mean, it'd be useful to just know that.
We get it as a in response to a data request in the spring of 08.
Excuse me?
Spring of 08.
Okay, I'm going to overrule the objection and let him answer then with respect to that clarification.
And
you could
have
you repeat the question?
The question had to do with whether staff has had enough time to review the cost study.
I believe yes. And Commissioner Johnson and I discussed this as well about what a reasonable time period would be for a study of this nature, given a cooperative company.
And do you have any information to add as to when staff was apprised of what I'll call the LECA cost study?
I have here a presentation, a printout of the presentation that was made before the staff in a meeting with staff, and it's dated April 17, 2007, and has the last slides. It has different sections in it, but one of the sections is explicitly labeled LECA model run. It lays out the methodology. It gives the summary sheets. Clearly, the LECA model that is attached to Mr. Fisher's testimony was presented to the staff in April 2007. And in fact, I believe staff has made some recommendations as to certain changes to QSI, and those changes were implemented. And that process, given the willingness of QSI to work with staff, I think staff could have capitalized on that and pursued the cost study to a much greater degree, but I presume it wasn't done because there was no interest in that.
Are you aware of whether or not Mid-Continent has expressed a willingness to work with the Commission on both ILEC and CLEC access charges?
Yes, I believe it has expressed a great willingness to do so.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Staff, do you have follow-up questions in response to the Commission's questions and Mr. Gerdes's redirect?
No.
Commissioner Kolbeck.
I have a question about the how the numbers are figured. Do you take into effect how much is charged on a monthly basis per customer when you're figuring in your cost study? In other words, if it's free, does that go into the cost study?
No, the end user charges to, the ordinary ratepayers on the retail side, those costs and those charges do not translate into the switch access cost. The switch access costs pertain only to the cost that Mid-Continent incurs when it makes its network available to companies like AT&T. When AT&T terminates its long-distance traffic on Mid-Continent, Mid-Continent incurs a cost for that. Those are the costs we calculated, and then what we're asking for is to recoup those costs, lest
Mid-Continent would be subsidizing a carrier like AT&T with no apparent benefit.
So what the customer pays on a monthly basis does not affect your switching costs. We're strictly talking about fixed switch costs.
Yes, the costs are only the inter-carrier costs that are included. And what you as a rate payer may be paying, if you, assuming that you were a Mid-Continent customer, what you pay doesn't figure into what Mid-Continent is charging the IXC, the long-distance carrier.
Thank you.
Any final commissioner questions? I think you may step down, Dr. Ankum. Thank you very much. Mr. Gerdes, do you have additional witnesses for your direct case?
May I just have a moment?
Yes. We'll take a short break here, a 5-minute break.